Jubal spoke to the replica of La Belle Aulmière. Do not listen, ma petite chère. He is a barbarian and knows no better. He put his hand to her beautiful, ravaged cheek, then gently touched one empty, shrunken dug. I know how you feel. It can't be much longer. Patience, my lovely. He turned to Caxton and said briskly, Ben, you will have to wait while I give you a lesson and have a look at sculpture. You've been rude to a lady. I don't tolerate that. Huh? Don't be silly, Jubal. You're rude to ladies. Live ones a dozen times a day. Jubal shouted, Anne, upstairs. Wear your cloak. You know I wouldn't be rude to the old woman who posed for that. What I can't understand is a so-called artist having the gall to pose somebody's great-grandmother in her skin, and you having the bad taste to want it around. Anne came in, cloaked. Jubal said, Anne, have I ever been rude to you, or to any of the girls? That calls for opinion. That's what I'm asking for. You're not in court. You have never been rude to any of us, Jubal. Have you ever known me to be rude to a lady? I have seen you be intentionally rude to a woman. I've never seen you be rude to a lady.
One more opinion. What do you think of this bronze?
Anne looked at Rodin's masterpiece, said slowly, When I first saw it, I thought it was horrible. But I've come to the conclusion that it may be the most beautiful thing I've ever seen.
Thanks, that's all.
She left.
Want to argue, Ben?
Huh? When I argue with Anne, that day I turn in my suit. But I don't grok it.
Attend me, Ben. Anybody can see a pretty girl. An artist can look at a pretty girl and see the old woman she will become. A better artist can look at an old woman and see the pretty girl she used to be. A great artist can look at an old woman, portray her exactly as she is, and force the viewer to see the pretty girl she used to be. More than that, he can make anyone with the sensitivity of an armadillo see that this lovely young girl is still alive, prisoned inside her ruined body. He can make you feel the quiet, endless tragedy that there was never a girl born who ever grew older than 18 in a heart, no matter what the merciless hours have done. Look at it, Ben. Growing old doesn't matter to you and me, but it does to them. Look at her.
Ben looked at her. Presently, Jubal said gruffly,
All right, blow your nose. Come sit down.
No, Caxton answered. How about this one? I see it's a girl, but why tie her up like a pretzel? Jubal looked at the replica, caryatid who has fallen under her stone.
I won't expect you to appreciate the masses, which make that figure much more than a pretzel. But you can appreciate what Rodin was saying. What do people get out of looking at a crucifix?
You know I don't go to church. Still, you must know that representations of the crucifixion are usually atrocious, and ones in churches are the worst. Blood like ketchup, and that ex-carpenter portrayed as if he were a pansy, which he certainly was not. He was a hearty man, muscular and healthy. But a poor portrayal is as effective as a good one for most people. They don't see defects. They see a symbol which inspires their deepest emotions. It recalls to them the agony and sacrifice of God.
Jubal, I thought you weren't a Christian. Does that make me blind to human emotion? The crummiest plaster crucifix can evoke emotions in the human heart so strong that many have died for them. The artistry with which such a symbol is wrought is irrelevant. Here we have another emotional symbol, but wrought with exquisite artistry.
Ben, for 3,000 years, architects designed buildings with columns shaped as female figures. At last, Rodin pointed out that this was work too heavy for a girl. He didn't say, Look, you jerks, if you must do this, make it a brawny male figure. No, he showed it. This poor little caryatid has fallen under the load. She's a good girl. Look at her face. Serious, unhappy at a failure, not blaming anyone, not even the gods, and still trying to shoulder her load after she's crumpled under it. But she's more than good art denouncing bad art. She's a symbol for every woman who ever shouldered a load too heavy. But not alone women. This symbol means every man and woman who ever sweated out life in uncomplaining fortitude until they crumpled under their loads. It's courage, Ben, and victory.
Victory?
Victory and defeat, there is none higher. She didn't give up, Ben.
She's still trying to lift that stone after it has crushed her. She's a father working while cancer eats away his insides to bring home one more paycheck. She's a 12-year-old trying to mother her brothers and sisters because Mama had to go to heaven. She's a switchboard operator sticking to a post while smoke chokes her and fire cuts off her escape. She's all the unsung heroes who couldn't make it, but never quit. Come, salute as you pass, and come see my little mermaid. Ben took him literally. Jubal made no comment. Now this, he said, is one Mike didn't give to me. I haven't told Mike why I got it, since it is self-evident that it's one of the most delightful compositions ever wrought by the eye and hand of man. This one I don't need explained. It's pretty, which is excuse enough, as with kittens and butterflies. But there is more. She's not quite a mermaid, see? Nor is she human. She sits on land, where she has chosen to stay, and stares eternally out to sea, forever lonely for what she left. You know the story? Hans Christian Andersen. Yes. She sits by the haven of Kubenhavn, and she's everybody who ever made a difficult choice. She doesn't regret it, but she must pay for it. Every choice must be paid for. The cost is not only endless homesickness. She can never be quite human. When she uses her dearly bought feet, every step is on sharp knives. Ben, I think that Mike walks always on knives, but don't tell him I said so. I won't. I'd rather look at her and not think about knives. She's a little darling, isn't she? How would you like to coax her into bed? She'd be as lively as a seal and as slippery. Cripes, you're an evil old man, Jubal. And getting eviler every year. We won't look at any others. I usually ration myself to one a day. Suits? I feel as if I had had three quick drinks. Jubal, why isn't there stuff like this where a person can see it? Because the world has gone nutty, and art always paints the spirit of its times. Rodin died about the time the world started flipping its lid. His successors noted the amazing things he had done with light and shadow and mass and composition, and they copied that part. What they failed to see was that the master told stories that laid bare the human heart. They became contemptuous of painting or sculpture that told stories. They dubbed such work literary. They went all out for abstractions. Jubal shrugged. Abstract design is all right. For wallpaper or linoleum, but art is the process of evoking pity and terror. What modern artists do is pseudo-intellectual masturbation. Creative art is intercourse, in which the artist renders emotional his audience. These laddies who won't deign to do that, or can't, lost the public. The ordinary bloke will not buy art that leaves him unmoved. If he does, the money is conned out of him by taxes or such. Jubal, I've always wondered why I didn't give a hoot for art. I thought it was something missing in me. One does have to learn to look at art. But it's up to the artist to use language that can be understood. Most of these jokers don't want to use language you and I can learn. They would rather sneer because we fail to see what they are driving at, if anything. Obscurity is the refuge of incompetence. Ben, would you call me an artist? Huh? You write a fair stick. Thank you. Artist is a word I avoid for the same reason I hate to be called doctor, but I am an artist. Most of my stuff is worth reading only once, and not even once by a person who knows the little I have to say, but I am an honest artist. What I write is intended to reach the customer, and affect him, if possible, with pity and terror, or at least divert the tedium of his hours. I never hide from him in a private language, nor am I seeking praise from other writers for technique or other balderdash. I want praise from the customer, given in cash, because I've reached him, or I don't want anything. Support for the arts? Mad. A government-supported artist is an incompetent whore. Damn it, you punched one of my buttons. Fill your glass and tell me what's on your mind. Jubal, I'm unhappy. This is news. I've got a fresh set of troubles. Ben frowned. I'm not sure I want to talk about them. Then listen to my troubles. You have troubles? Jubal, I thought you were the one man who had managed to beat the game. Sometime I must tell you about my married life. Yes, I've got troubles. Duke has left. Or did you know? I knew. Larry is a good gardener, but the gadgets that run this Hogan are falling to pieces. Good mechanics are scarce. Ones that will fit into this household are almost non-existent. I'm limping along on repairmen, every visit a disturbance, all of them with larceny in their hearts, and most of them can't use a screwdriver without cutting themselves. Nor can I, so I'm at their mercy. My heart aches for you, Jubal. Never mind the sarcasm. Mechanics and gardeners are convenient. Secretaries are essential. Two of mine are pregnant. One is getting married. Caxton looked flabbergasted. Jubal growled, Oh, I'm not telling tales. They're sore because I took you up here without giving them time to boast, so be surprised when they tell you. Which one is getting married? Isn't that obvious? The happy man is that smooth-talking refugee from a sandstorm or a Steamwater Brother Stinky Mahmood. I told him that they have to live here whenever they're in this country. Bastard laughed and pointed out that I had invited him too long ago. Jubal sniffed. Wouldn't be so bad if he would. I might get some work out of her. Probably would. She likes to work. The other two are pregnant. High on a kite. I'm refreshing an OB because they say they're going to have them at home. What a crimp babies will put in my working habits. But why do you assume that neither turgescent tummy belongs to the bride? Why, I assume that Stinky was more conventional than that. Or more cautious. Stinky wouldn't be given a ballot. Ben, in all the years I've studied this subject, trying to trace the meanderings of their twisted little minds, the only thing I've learned is that when a gal is gonna, she's gonna. All a man can do is cooperate with the inevitable. Well, which one isn't getting married or anything? Miriam or Anne? Hold it, I didn't say the bride was pregnant. And you seem to be thinking that Dorcas is the prospective bride. It's Miriam who is studying Arabic. Huh? I'm a cross-eyed baboon. Obviously. But Miriam was always snapping at Stinky, and they trust you with the newspaper column. Ever watch a bunch of sixth graders? Yes, but Dorcas did everything but a notch dance. That is Dorcas's natural behavior. Be sure that when Miriam shows you her ring, size of a roc's egg and about as scarce, act surprised. I'm damned if I'll sort out which are spawning. Just remember that they are pleased, which is why I tipped you off so that you wouldn't think they thought they were caught. They don't. They weren't. They're smug. Jubal sighed. I'm too old to enjoy the patter of little feet, but I won't lose perfect secretaries and kids that I love for any reason if I can induce them to stay. This household has become steadily disorganized ever since Jill kicked Mike's feet out from under him. Not that I blame her, and I don't think you do either. No, but... Jubal, are you under the impression that Jill started Mike on his merry rounds? Huh? Jubal looked startled. Then who was it? Don't be nosy, bub. However, Jill straightened me out when I jumped to the same conclusion. As I understand it, which one scored first was more or less chance. Hmm. Yes, I believe so. Jill thinks so. She thinks Mike was lucky in happening to seduce or be seduced by the one best fitted to start him off right. Which gives you a hint if you know how Jill's mind works. Hell, I don't even know how mine works. As for Jill, I would never have expected her to take up preaching, no matter how love-struck she was. So I don't know how her mind works. She doesn't preach much. We'll get to that. Jubal, what do you read from the calendar? Huh? You think Mike did it, in both cases, if his visits home match up? Jubal said guardedly. Ben, I've said nothing to lead you to think so. The hell you haven't. You said they were smug. I know the effect that goddamn Superman has on women. Hold it, son. He's our water brother. Ben said levelly. I know it. And I love him, too. But that's all the more reason I understand why they are smug. Jubal stared at his glass. Ben, seems to me your name could be on the list easier than Mike's. Jubal, you're out of your mind. Take it easy. While I really do so help me by all the billion names of God, believe in not poking my nose into other people's business, nevertheless, I have normal eyesight and hearing. If a brass band parades through my home, I notice. You slept under this roof dozens of times. Did you ever sleep alone? Why, you scoundrel, I slept alone the first night I was here. Dorcas must have been off her feed. No, you want a sedative that night, doesn't count. Some other night? Your question is irrelevant, immaterial, and beneath my notice. That's an answer. Please note that the added bedrooms are as far from mine as possible. Soundproofing is never perfect. Jubal, wouldn't your name be higher up that list than mine? What? Not to mention Larry and Duke. Jubal, everybody assumes that you are keeping the fanciest harem since the Sultan. Don't misunderstand me, they envy you. But they think you're a lecherous old goat. Jubal drummed on his chair arm. Ben, I do not mind being treated flippantly by my juniors. But in this matter, I insist that my years be treated with respect. Sorry, Ben said stiffly. I thought if it was all right for you to kick my sex life around, you would not mind my being equally frank. No, no, Ben, you misunderstand. I require the girls to treat me with respect on this subject. Oh, I am, as you pointed out, old. Quite old. Privately, I am happy to say that I am still lecherous, but lechery does not command me. I prefer dignity to indulging in pastimes which, believe me, I have enjoyed in full measure and do not need to repeat. Ben, a man my age who looks like a slum clearance in its grimmest stage can bed a young girl, and possibly bigger, and thanks for the compliment, it might not be amiss, through three means. Money, or the equivalent in terms of wills and community property and such. And, pause for a question, can you imagine any of these four bedding with a man for those reasons? No, not any of them. Thank you, sir. I associate only with ladies. I'm pleased that you know it. The third incentive is a most female one. A sweet young girl sometimes takes an old wreck to bed because she is fond of him, sorry for him, and wishes to make him happy. Would that apply? Jubal, it might, with any of them. I think so, too. But this reason, which any of these ladies might find sufficient, is not sufficient for me. I have my dignity, sir, so please take my name off the list. Caxton grinned. Okay, you stiff-necked old coot. I hope that when I'm your age, I won't be so hard to tempt. Jubal smiled. Better to be tempted and resist than be disappointed. Now about Duke and Larry, I don't know, nor care. Whenever anyone comes here to live, I make it plain that this is neither a sweatshop nor a whorehouse, but a home, and as such it combines anarchy and tyranny without a trace of democracy as in any well-run family. I.e., they are on their own except where I give orders, which orders are not subject to debate. My tyranny never extends to love life. The kids have always kept their private matters reasonably private. At least, Jubal smiled ruefully, until the Martian influence got out of hand. Perhaps Duke and Larry had been dragging the gals behind every bush, but there have been no screams. Then you think it's Mike? Jubal scowled. Yes. That's all right. I told you the girls were smugly happy. And I'm not broke, plus the fact that I could bleed Mike for any amount their babies won't lack. But Ben, I'm troubled about Mike himself. So am I, Jubal. And about Jill. Jubal, Jill isn't the problem. It's Mike. Damn it, why can't the boy come home and quit this obscene pulpit pounding? Jubal, that's not quite what he's doing. Ben added. I've just come from there. Huh? Why didn't you say so? Ben sighed. First you talked art, then you sang the blues, then you wanted to gossip. You have the flow. Coming back from the Cape Town conference, I visited them. What I saw worried the hell out of me, so I stopped by my office, then came here. Jubal, couldn't you rig it with Douglas to close down this operation? Jubal shook his head. What Mike does with his life is his business. You would if you had seen what I saw. Not I. But in the second place, I can't. Nor can Douglas. Jubal, Mike would accept any decision you made about his money. He probably wouldn't even understand it. Ah, but he would. Ben, recently Mike made his will and sent it to me to criticize. It was one of the shrewdest documents I've ever seen. He recognized that he had more wealth than his heirs could use, so he used part of his money to guard the rest. It is booby-trapped not only against heirs' claimants of both his legal and natural parents. He knows he's a bastard, though I don't know how he found out. but also of every member of the envoy's company. He provided a way to settle out of court with any heir having a prima facie claim, and rigged it so that they would almost have to overthrow the government to break his will. The will showed that he knew every security and asset. I couldn't find anything to criticize. Including, Jubal thought, his provision for you, my brother.
Don't tell me that I could rig his money.
Ben looked morose.
I wish you could. I don't. But it wouldn't help if we could. Mike hasn't drawn a dollar from his account for almost a year. Douglas called me about it. Mike hadn't answered his letters.
No withdrawals?
Jubilee's spending a lot. Maybe the church racket pays well. That's the odd part. It's not really a church. What is it?
Primarily a language school.
Repeat?
To teach the Martian language.
Well, then I wish he wouldn't call it a church.
Maybe it is a church within the legal definition. Look, Ben, a skating rink is a church as long as some sect claims that skating is essential to worship, or even that skating served a desirable function. If you can sing to the glory of God, you can skate to the same end. There are temples in Malaya which are nothing to an outsider but boarding houses for snakes. But the same high court rules them to be churches as protects our own sex.
Well, Mike raises snakes, too.
Jubal, isn't anything ruled out?
A moot point.
A church usually can't charge for fortune-telling or calling up spirits of the dead, but it can accept offerings and let the offerings be fees, in fact. Human sacrifice is illegal, but it is done in several spots around the globe, probably right here in this former land of the free. The way to do anything that would otherwise be suppressed is to do it in the inner sanctum and keep the Gentiles out.
Why, Ben? Is Mike doing something that might get him jailed?
Probably not.
Well, if he's careful. The Fostrites have shown how to get by with almost anything, much more than Joseph Smith was lynched for.
Mike has lifted a lot from the Fosterites. That's part of what worries me.
But what does worry you?
Jubal, this is a water brother matter. Shall I carry poison in a hollow tooth? The inner circle are supposed to be able to discorporate voluntarily. No poison needed.
I never got that far, Ben. But I know ways to put up the only final defense.
Let's have it. Jubal, I said Mike raises snakes. I meant figuratively and literally. The setup is a snake pit, unhealthy. Mike's temple is a big place, an auditorium for public meetings, smaller ones for invitational meetings, many smaller rooms, and living quarters. Jill sent me a radiogram telling me where to go, so I was dropped at the private entrance on the back street. Quarters are above the auditorium, as private as he can be and still live in a city. Jubal nodded.
Be your acts legal or illegal, nosy neighbors are noxious.
In this case, a very good idea. Outer doors let me in. I suppose I was scanned, although I didn't spot the scanner. Through two more automatic doors, then up a bounce tube. Jubal, it wasn't an ordinary one, not controlled by the passenger, but by someone out of sight. Didn't feel like the usual bounce tube, either.
I have never used them, and never shall, Jubal said firmly.
You wouldn't have minded this. I floated up gently as a feather.
Ben, I don't trust machinery. It bites.
Jubal added,
however, Mike's mother was one of the great engineers, and his father, his real father, was a competent engineer, or better. If Mike has improved bounce tubes until they are fit for humans, we ought not to be surprised.
As may be. I got to the top and landed without having to grab for it or depend on safety nets. Didn't see any, to tell the truth. Through more automatic doors and into an enormous living room, oddly furnished and rather austere. Jubal, people think you run an odd household.
Nonsense, just plain and comfortable.
Well, your menage is Aunt Jane's finishing school compared with Mike's weirdy. I'm just inside the joint when the first thing I see, I don't believe, a babe tattooed from chin to toes and not a goddamn stitch on. Hell, she was tattooed everywhere.
Fantastic. You're a big city bumpkin, Ben. I knew a tattooed lady once. Very nice girl.
Well, Ben conceded. This gal is nice, too, once you get adjusted to her pictorial supplement, and the fact that she usually has a snake with her.
I was wondering if it was the same woman. Fully tattooed women are scarce. But the lady I knew 30 years back had the usual vulgar fear of snakes. However, I'm fond of snakes. I look forward to meeting your friend.
You will when you visit Mike. She's sort of a major domo for him, Patricia, but called Pat or Patty.
Oh, yes, Jill thinks highly of her. Never mentioned her tattoos, however.
But she's nearly the age to be your friend. When I said babe, I was giving a first impression. She looks to be in her 20s. She claims her oldest child is that old. Anyhow, she trotted up, all big smile, put her arms around me, and kissed me.
You're Ben. Welcome, brother. I give you water.
Jubal, I've been in the newspaper racket for years. I've been around. But I have never been kissed by a strange babe dressed only in tattoos. I was embarrassed.
Poor Ben.
Damn it, you would have felt the same way.
No, remember, I've met one tattooed lady. They feel dressed in those tattoos. Or at least this was true of my friend Sadako. Japanese she was, but Japanese are not body conscious the way we are.
Well, Ben answered, Pat isn't body conscious, just about her tattoos. She wants to be stuffed and mounted nude when she dies as a tribute to George.
George?
Sorry, her husband. Up in heaven, to my relief, although she talked as if he had just slipped out for a beer. But essentially, Pat is a lady, and she didn't let me stay embarrassed.
Chapter 31
Patricia Piwanski gave Ben Caxton the all-out kiss of brotherhood before he knew what hit him. She felt his unease and was surprised. Mike had told her to expect him and placed Ben's face in her mind. She knew that Ben was a brother in all fullness of the inner nest. And Jill was grown closer with Ben, second only to that with Michael. But Patricia's nature was an endless wish to make other people as happy as she was. She slowed down. She invited Ben to get rid of his clothes, but did not press the matter, except to ask him to remove his shoes. The nest was soft and clean, as only Michael's powers could keep things clean. She showed him where to hang clothes and hurried to fetch him a drink. She knew his preferences from Jill and decided on a double martini. The poor dear looked tired. When she came back with drinks, Ben was barefooted and had removed his jacket.
Brother, may you never thirst.
We share water. He agreed, and drank.
There's mighty little water in that.
Enough, she answered. Michael says that water could be in the thought. It is the sharing. I grok he speaks rightly.
I grok. And just what I needed. Thanks, Patty.
Ours is yours, and you are ours. We're glad you're home. The others are at services or teaching. There's no hurry. They will come when waiting is filled. Would you like to look around your nest?
Ben let her lead him on a tour. A huge kitchen with a bar at one end, a library even more loaded than Jubal's, bathrooms ample and luxurious, bedrooms. Ben decided that they must be bedrooms, although they contained no beds, but simply floors that were even softer than elsewhere. Patty called them little nests and showed him the one she usually slept in. It had been fitted on one side for her snakes. Ben suppressed his queasiness until he came to cobras.
It's all right, she assured him. We did have glass in front of them, but Michael has taught them that they must not come past this line.
I would rather trust glass.
Okay, Ben.
She lowered a glass barrier. He felt relieved and managed to stroke Honeybun when invited to. Then Pat showed him one other room. It was very large, circular, had a floor as cushiony as the bedrooms. Its center was a round swimming pool.
This, she told him, is the innermost temple where we receive new brothers into the nest.
She dabbled a foot in water.
Want to share water and grow closer? Or maybe just swim?
Not right now.
Waiting is, she agreed.
They returned to the huge living room, and Patricia went to get him another drink. Ben settled himself on a big couch, then got up. The place was warm. That drink was making him sweat, and a couch that adjusted to his contours made him hotter. He decided it was silly to dress the way he would in Washington, with Patty decked out in nothing but a bull snake she had left around her shoulders. He compromised on jockey shorts and hung the rest in the foyer. Then he noticed a sign on the entrance door. Did you remember to dress? He decided that in this household, the warning might be necessary. He saw nothing else that he had missed on coming in. On each side of the door was a huge brass bowl, filled with money. More than filled. Federation notes of various denominations spilled out on the floor. He was staring at this when Patricia returned.
Here's your drink, Brother Ben. Grow close in happiness.
Thanks.
His eyes returned to the money. She followed his glance.
I'm a sloppy housekeeper, Ben. Michael makes it so easy, cleaning and such, that I forget.
She retrieved the money, stuffed it into the less crowded bowl.
Patty, why in the world?
Oh, we keep it here because this door leads to the street. If one of us is leaving the nest, and I do myself almost every day for grocery shopping, we may need money. We keep it where you won't forget to take some.
Just grab a handful and go?
Why, yes, dear. Oh, I see what you mean. There is never anyone here but us. If we have friends outside, and all of us do, there are rooms lower down, the sort outsiders are used to where we visit. This isn't where it can tempt a weak person.
Huh. I'm pretty weak myself.
She chuckled. How can it tempt you when it's yours?
How about burglars?
He tried to guess how much money those bowls contained. Most of the notes seemed to be larger than singles. Hell, he could see one with 3 zeros on the floor. Patty had missed it. One did get in last week.
So, how much did he steal?
Oh, he didn't. Michael sent him away.
Called the cops?
Oh, no! Michael would never turn anybody over to cops. Michael just... She shrugged. Made him go away. Then Duke fixed the hole in the skylight in the garden room. Did I show you that? It's lovely, a grass floor. You have a grass floor, Jill told me. That's where Michael first saw one. Is it grass all over?
Just my living room.
If I ever get to Washington, can I walk on it? Lie down on it, please?
Of course, Patty. It's yours.
I know, dear, but it is good to ask. I'll lie on it and feel the grass against me, and be filled with happiness to be in my brother's little nest.
You're most welcome, Patty.
He hoped she would leave her snakes behind.
When will you be there?
I don't know, when waiting is filled. Maybe Michael knows.
Well, warn me if possible, so I'll be in town. If not, Jill always knows my door code.
Patty, doesn't anybody keep track of this money? What for, Ben?
People usually do.
We don't. Just help yourself, then put back any you have left when you come home, if you remember. Michael told me to keep the grouch bag filled. If it runs low, I get more from him.
Ben dropped the matter, stunkered by its simplicity. He had some idea of the moneyless communism of Martian culture. He could see that Mike had set up an enclave of it here. These bowls marked transition from Martian to Terran economy. He wondered if Patty knew that it was fake, propped up by Mike's wealth.
Patty, how many are there in the nest?
He felt a mild worry, then shoved back the thought. Why would they sponge on him? He didn't have pots of gold inside his door. Let me see. Almost 20, counting novitiate brothers who don't think in Martian yet and aren't ordained.
Are you ordained, Patty?
Oh, yes. Mostly I teach. Beginner's classes in Martian, and I help novitiates and such. And Dawn and Jill are high priestesses. Dawn and I are pretty well-known Fosterites, so we work together to show other Fosterites that the Church of All World doesn't conflict with the faith any more than being a Baptist keeps a man from joining the Masons.
She showed Ben Foster's kiss, explained it, and showed him its miraculous companion placed by Mike.
They know what Foster's kiss means and how hard it is to win it, and they've seen some of Mike's miracles, and are about ripe to buckle down and climb into a higher circle.
It's an effort?
Of course, Ben. For them. In your case and mine, and Jill's and a few others, Michael called us straight into brotherhood. But to others, Michael first teaches a discipline. Not a faith, but a way to realize faith in works. That means they've got to learn Martian. That's not easy. I'm not perfect in it. But it is happiness to work and learn. You asked about the nest. Let me see. Duke and Jill and Michael. 2 Fosterites, Dawn and myself. 1 circumcised Jew and his wife and 4 children.
Kids in the nest?
Oh, lots of them. In the nestling's nest, just off of here. Nobody could meditate with kids hollering and raising Ned. Want to see it?
Later.
1 Catholic couple with a little boy, excommunicated, I'm sorry to say, their priest found out. Michael had to give them special help. It was a nasty shock, and utterly unnecessary. They were getting up early every Sunday to go to Mass as usual. But kids will talk. 1 Mormon family of the new schism. That's 3 more, and their kids. The rest are Protestants, and 1 atheist. That is, he thought he was until Michael opened his eyes. He came here to scoff. He stayed to learn.
You'll be a priest soon. I'm 19 grown-ups, but we're hardly ever all in the nest at once, except for our own services in the innermost temple. The nest is built to hold 81, three-filled. But Michael Grock's much waiting before we need a bigger nest, and by then we will build other nests. Ben, would you like to see an outer service? See how Michael makes the pitch? Michael is preaching now.
Why, yes, if it's not too much trouble.
Good. Just a sec, dearie, while I get decent. Jubal, she came back in a robe like Anne's witness robe, but with angel wing sleeves and a high neck and the trademark Mike uses, 9 concentric circles and a conventionalized sun over her heart. His getup was vestments. Jill and the other priestesses wear the same, except that Patty's was high-necked to cover her cartoons. She had put on socks and was carrying sandals. Changed the hell out of her, Jubal. It gave her great dignity. I could see she was older than I had guessed, although not within years of what she claims. She has an exquisite complexion, a shame ever to tattoo such skin. I addressed again. She asked me to carry my shoes and led me back through the nest and out into the corridor. We stopped to put on shoes and took a ramp that wound down a couple of floors. We reached a gallery overlooking the main auditorium. Mike was on the platform. No pulpit, just a lecture hall with a big all-world symbol on the back wall. A priestess was with him, and at that distance I thought it was Jill. But it was the other high priestess, Dawn. Dawn Ardent.
What was that name?
Dawn Ardent. Nay Higgins, if you want to be fussy.
I've met her.
I know you have, you allegedly retired goat. She's got a crush on you. Jubal shook his head.
The Dawn Ardent, I mean, I just barely met 2 years ago. She wouldn't remember me.
She remembers you. She gets every one of your pieces of commercial cred on tape under every pseudonym she can track down. She goes to sleep by them. They give her beautiful dreams, she says. But they all know you, Jubal. That living room has exactly one ornament, a life-sized color solly of your head. Looks as if you had been decapitated with your face in a hideous grin. A shot Duke sneaked of you.
Why, that brat.
Jill asked him to.
Double brat.
Mike put her up to it. Brace yourself, Jubal.
You are the patron saint of the Church of All Worlds.
Jubal looked horrified.
They can't do that.
They already have. Mike gives you credit for having started the whole show by explaining things so well that he was able to figure out how to put over Martian theology to humans. Jubal groaned. Ben went on. In addition, Dawn thinks you're beautiful. Aside from that quirk, she is intelligent and utterly charming. But I digress. Mike spotted us and called out, "Hi, Ben, later," and went on with his spiel. Jubal, you'll have to hear it. He didn't sound preachy and didn't wear robes, just a smart, well-tailored white suit. He sounded like a damned good car salesman. He cracked jokes and told parables. The gist was a sort of pantheism. One parable was the oldie about the earthworm burrowing through the soil who encounters another earthworm and says, "Oh, you're beautiful, will you marry me?" And his answer, "Don't be silly, I'm your other end." You've heard it?
Heard it. I wrote it.
Hadn't realized it was that old. Mike made good use of it. His idea is that whenever you encounter any other grokking thing, man, woman, or stray cat, you are meeting your other end. The universe is a thing we whipped up among us and agreed to forget the gag. Jubal looked sour.
Solipsism and pantheism. Together they explain anything, cancel out any inconvenient fact, reconcile all theories, include any facts or delusions you like. But it's cotton candy, all taste and no substance. As unsatisfactory as solving a story by saying, "Then the little boy fell out of bed and woke up."
Don't crab at me, take it up with Mike. Believe me, he made it convincing. Once he stopped and said, "You must be tired of so much talk." And they yelled back, "No!" He really had them. He protested that his voice was tired, and anyhow it was time for miracles. Then he did amazing sleight of hand. Did you know he had been a magician in a carnival?
I knew he had been with it. He never told me the nature of his shame.
He's a crackerjack. He did stunts that had me fooled. But it would have been okay if he had just used kid tricks. It was his patter that had them spellbound. Finally, he stopped and said, "The man from Mars is expected to do wonderful things, so I pass some miracles each meeting. I can't help being the man from Mars. It's just something that happened. Miracles can happen for you, if you want them. However, for anything more than these narrow-gauge miracles, you must enter the circle. Those who want to learn, I will see you later. Cards are being passed around." Patty explained it.
This crowd is just Mark's, dear. People here out of curiosity, or maybe shilled in by people who have reached one of the inner circles.
Tubal Micah's rigged the thing in 9 circles, like lodge degrees, and nobody is told that there are circles farther in until they're ripe for it.
This is Michael's bally, Pat told me, which he does as easy as he breathes, while he's feeling them out and deciding which ones are possible. That's why he strings it out. Duke is up behind that grill, and Michael tells him who might measure up, where he sits and everything.
Michael's about to turn this tip and spill the ones he doesn't want. Then Dawn takes over, after she gets the seating diagram from Duke.
How did they work that? Asked Harshaw.
I didn't see it, Jubal. There are a dozen ways they could cut from the herd, as long as Mike knew which they were and had some way to signal Duke.
Patty says Mike's clairvoyant. I won't deny the possibility.
Then they took the collection. Mike doesn't do even this church style, you know, soft music and dignified ushers. He said nobody would believe this was a church if he didn't take a collection. Then so help me. They passed collection baskets already loaded with money, and Mike told them that this was what the last crowd had given, so help themselves if they were broke or hungry and needed it. But if they felt like giving, give. Do one or the other. Put something in or take something out.
I figured he had found one more way to get rid of too much money.
Jubal said thoughtfully.
That pitch, properly given, should result in people giving more, while a few just take a little.
Probably very few.
I don't know, Jubal. Patty whisked me away when Mike turned the service over to Dawn. She took me to a private auditorium where services were opening for the 7th circle, people who had belonged for months and had made progress. If it is progress.
Jubal, we went straight from one to the other, and it was hard to adjust. That outer meeting was half lecture, half entertainment. This one was almost a voodoo rite. Mike was in robes now. He looked taller, ascetic, and intense. His eyes gleamed. The place was dim. There was creepy music. And yet it made you want to dance.
Patty and I took a couch that was darn near a bed.
What the service was, I couldn't say. Mike would sing out in Martian. They would answer in Martian. Except for chants of thou art God, echoed by some Martian word that would make my throat sore to pronounce it.
Jubal made a croaking noise.
Was that it?
Huh? I believe so, Jubal.
Are you hooked? Have you been stringing me along?
No, Stinky taught it to me.
He says it's heresy of the blackest sort, by his lights, I mean. It's the word Mike translates as thou art God. Mahmood says that isn't even close to a translation. It's the universe proclaiming its self-awareness, or its peccavimus, with the total absence of contrition, or a dozen other things.
Stinky says that he doesn't understand it even in Martian, except that it's a bad word, the worst possible in his opinion, and closer to Satan's defiance than to the blessing of God.
Go on. Was that all? Just a bunch of fanatics yelling Martian?
Jubal, they didn't yell, and it wasn't fanatical. Sometimes they barely whispered. Then it might climb a little. They did it in a rhythm, a pattern, like a cantata. Yet it didn't feel rehearsed. It felt more as if they were all one person, humming whatever he felt.
Jubal, you've seen Fosterites work themselves up.
Too much, I'm sorry to say.
Well, this was not that sort of frenzy. This was quiet and easy, like dropping off to sleep. It was intense, all right, and got steadily more so, but...
Jubal, ever try a spiritualist seance?
I have. I've tried everything I could, Ben.
Then you know how tension can grow without anybody moving or saying a word. This was more like that than like a revival, or even the most sedate church service. But it wasn't mild. It packed terrific wallop.
The word is Apollonian,
huh?
As opposed to Dionysian.
People simplify Apollonian into mild and calm and cool.
But Apollonian and Dionysian are two sides of one coin. A nun kneeling in a cell, holding perfectly still, can be in ecstasy more frenzied than any priestess of Pan Pipe or celebrating the vernal equinox. Ecstasy is in the skull, not the setting up exercises.
Jubal frowned.
Another error is to identify Apollonian with good, merely because our most respectable sects are Apollonian in ritual and precept. Mere prejudice.
Proceed.
Well, things weren't as quiet as a nun's devotions. They wandered about, swapped seats, and there was necking going on. Nothing more, I believe, but the lighting was low. One gal started to join us, but Patty gave her some sign, so she kissed us and left.
Ben grinned.
Kissed quite well, too. I was the only person not in a robe. I felt conspicuous, but she didn't seem to notice. The whole thing was casual,
and yet as coordinated as a ballerina's muscles. Mike kept busy, sometimes in front, sometimes wandering among the others. Once he squeezed my shoulder and kissed Patty, unhurriedly but quickly. He didn't speak. Back of where he stood, when he seemed to be leading, was a dingus like a big stereo tank. He used it for miracles, only he never used the word, at least not in English. Jubal, every church promises miracles. But it's jam yesterday and jam tomorrow.
Exception, Jubal interrupted. Many of them deliver. Exempli gratia among many, Christian Scientists and Roman Catholics.
Catholics? You mean Lord?
I had in mind the miracle of transubstantiation.
I can't judge that subtle a miracle. As for Christian Scientists, if I break a leg, I want a sawbones.
Then watch where you put your feet. Jubal growled. Don't bother me.
Wouldn't think of it. I don't want a classmate of William Harvey.
Harvey could reduce a fracture.
Yeah, but how about his classmates? Jubal, those cases you cited may be miracles, but Mike offers splashy ones. He's either an expert illusionist or an amazing hypnotist.
He might be both.
Or he smoothed the bugs out of closed-circuit stereo vision so that it cannot be told from reality.
How can you rule out real miracles, Ben?
It's not a theory I like. Whatever he used, it was good theater. Once the lights came up, and he was a black-maned lion, as stately as a guardian for library steps, and the little lambs wobbling around him, the lion just blinked and yawned. Sure, Hollywood can tape such effects, but I smelled lion. However, that can be faked, too.
Why insist on fakery?
Damn it, I'm trying to be judicial.
And don't lean over backwards. Try to emulate Anne.
I'm not Anne. I wasn't judicial at the time, I just enjoyed it, in a warm glow. Mike did a lot of gung-ho illusions, levitation and such. Patty slipped away toward the end after whispering to me to stay. Michael just told them that any who do not feel ready for the next circle should now leave, she told me. I said I'd better leave. She said, oh no, dear, you're ninth circle. Stay seated. I'll be back. And she left. I don't think anybody chickened out. This group was seventh circlers supposed to be promoted. But I didn't notice as lights came up again. And there was Jill. Jubal, it did not feel like stereovision. Jill picked me out and smiled at me. Oh, if an actor looks directly at camera, his eyes meet yours no matter where you're seated. But if Mike had it smoothed out this well, he should patent it. Jill was in an outlandish costume. Mike started intoning something, partly in English, stuff about the mother of all, the unity of many, and started calling her a series of names. And with each name, her costume changed. Ben Caxton came quickly alert when he saw Jill. He was not fooled by lighting and distance. This was Jill. She looked at him and smiled. He half listened to the invocation while thinking that he had been convinced that the space behind the man from Mars was surely a stereo tank. But he would swear that he could walk up those steps and pinch her. He was tempted to, but it would be a crummy trick to ruin Mike's show. Wait till Jill was free.
Sibylle.
Jill's costume suddenly changed.
Isis.
Again.
Frigg. G. Devil. Ishtar. Mariam. Mother Eve. Mater Deum Magna, loving and beloved, life undying.
Caxton stopped hearing. Jill was Mother Eve, clothed in glory, light spread, and he saw that she was in a garden beside a tree on which was twined a great serpent. Jill smiled, reached up and smoothed the serpent's head, turned back and opened her arms. Candidates moved forward to enter the garden. Patty returned and touched Caxton on the shoulder. Ben, come, dear. Caxton wanted to stay and drink in the glorious vision of Jill. He wanted to join that procession. But he got up and left. He looked back and saw Mike put his arms around the first woman in line, turned to follow Patricia, and failed to see the candidate's robe vanish as Mike kissed her, did not see Jill kiss the first male candidate, and his robe vanished. We'll go around, Patty explained, to give them time to get into the temple. Oh, we could barge in, but it would waste Michael's time getting them back in the mood, and he does work so very hard.
Where are we going?
To pick up Honeybun, then back to the nest. Unless you want to take part in the initiation, but you haven't learned Martian yet, you'll find it confusing.
Well, I'd like to see Jill.
Oh, she said to tell you she's going to duck upstairs and see you. Down this way, Ben.
A door opened,
Ben found himself in that garden. The serpent raised her head as they came in.
"There, dear," Patricia said. "You were Mama's good girl."
She unwrapped the boa and flaked it down into a basket. "Duke brought her down, but I have to arrange her on the tree and tell her not to wander off." "You were lucky, Ben. The transition to eighth happens very seldom."
Ben carried Honeybun and learned that a 14-foot snake is a load. The basket had steel braces.
When they reached the top, Patricia stopped. "Put her down, Ben." She took off her robe and handed it to him, then draped the snake around her. "This is Honeybun's reward for being a good girl. She expects to cuddle up to Mama. I've got a class almost at once, so I'll carry her until the last moment. It's not a goodness to disappoint a snake. They're like babies. They can't grok in fullness."
They walked 50 yards to the entrance of the nest proper. Ben took off her sandals and socks after he removed his shoes. They went inside, and Patty stayed with him while Ben shucked down to shorts, stalling, trying to make up his mind to discard shorts, too. He was now fairly certain that clothing inside the nest was as unconventional and possibly as rude as hobnailed boots on a dance floor. The warning on the exit door, the absence of windows, the womb-like comfort of the nest, Patricia's lack of attire, plus the fact that she had suggested that he could do likewise, all added up to domestic nudity. Patricia's behavior he discounted from a feeling that a tattooed lady might have odd habits about clothing, but coming into the living room, they passed a man headed out toward the baths and little nests, and he wore less than Patricia by one snake and many pictures. He greeted them with, "Thou art God," and went on. There was more evidence in the living room. A body sprawled on a couch. A woman. Caxton knew that many families were casually naked in their homes, and this was a family, all water brothers. But he was unable to make up his mind between the urbanity of removing his symbolic fig leaf and the certainty that if he did, and strangers came in who were dressed, he would feel silly. Hell, he might blush.
"What would you have done, Jubal?"
Harshaw lifted his eyebrows.
"Are you expecting me to be shocked, Ben? The human body is often pleasing, frequently depressing, and never significant, per se. So Mike runs his household along nudist lines. Shall I cheer, or must I cry? Damn it, Jubal, it's easy to be Olympian, but I've never seen you take off your pants in company. Nor will you. But I grok you were not motivated by modesty. You were suffering from a morbid fear of appearing ridiculous, a neurosis with a long pseudo-Greek name."
"Nonsense. I wasn't certain what was polite."
"Nonsense to you, sir. You knew what was polite, but were afraid of looking silly, or feared being surprised in the gallant reflex. But I grok Mike has reasons for this custom." "Mike always has reasons."
"Oh, yes. Jill told me."
Ben was in the foyer, his back to the living room and his hands on his shorts, having told himself to take the plunge, when arms came snugly around his waist.
"Ben, darling, how wonderful!"
Then Jill was in his arms, her mouth warm and greedy against his. And he was glad he had not finished stripping. She was no longer Mother Eve. She was wearing a priestess robe. Nevertheless, he was happily aware that he held a double armful of live, warm, and gently squirming girl.
"Golly," she said, breaking from the kiss. "I've missed you, you old beast. Thou art God."
"Thou art God," he conceded. "Jill, you're prettier than ever."
"Yes,"
she agreed. "It does that.
What a thrill it gave me to catch your eye at the blow-off."
"Blow-off?"
"Jill means," Patricia put in, "the end of the service where she is all mother, mater deo magna. Kids, I must rush."
"Never hurry, Patty Cake."
"I gotta rush so I won't have to hurry.
Ben, I must put Honey Bun to bed and go down and take my class. So kiss me goodnight, please."
Ben found himself kissing a woman wrapped in a giant snake. He tried to ignore Honey Bun and treat Patty as she deserved. Pat then kissed Jill.
"Night, dears."
She left, unhurriedly.
"Ben, isn't she a lamb?"
"She is. Although she had me baffled at first."
"I grok. Patty baffles everybody. Because she never has doubts. She automatically does the right thing. She's much like Mike. She's the most advanced of any of us. She ought to be high priestess. But she won't take it because her tattoos would make some duties difficult, be a distraction. And she doesn't want them taken off."
"How could you take off that much tattooing? With a flensing knife, it would kill her." Not at all, dear. Mike could take them off, not leave a trace, and not hurt her. But she doesn't think of them as belonging to her. She's just their custodian. Come, sit down. Dawn will fetch supper. I must eat while we visit, or I won't have a chance until tomorrow. Tell me what you think. Dawn tells me you saw an outsider's service.
Yes.
Well?
Mike, Caxton said slowly, could sell shoes to snakes.
Then I grok something is bothering you.
No, he answered. Not anything I can put my finger on.
I'll ask you again in a week or two. No hurry.
I won't be here in a week.
You have columns on the spike?
3. But I shouldn't stay that long.
I think you will. Then you'll phone in a few, probably about the church. By then you will grok to stay much longer.
I don't think so.
Waiting is, until fullness. You know it's not a church?
Patty said something of the sort.
Let's say it's not a religion. It is a church in every legal and moral sense. But we're not trying to bring people to God. That's a contradiction. You can't say it in Martian. We're not trying to save souls. Souls can't be lost. We're not trying to get people to have faith. What we offer is not faith, but truth. Truth they can check. Truth for here and now. Truth, as matter of fact, is an ironing board and as useful as bread. So practical that it can make war and hunger and violence and hate as unnecessary as, well, as clothes in the nest. But they have to learn Martian. That's the hitch. Finding people honest enough to believe what they see, willing to work hard. It is hard to learn the language it must be taught in. This truth can't be stated in English any more than Beethoven's 5th can be.
She smiled.
But Mike never hurries. He screens thousands, finds a few, and some trickle into the nest and he trains them further. Someday Mike will have us so thoroughly trained that we can start other nests, then it can snowball. But there's no hurry. None of us is really trained. Are we, dear?
Ben looked up at Jill's last words, was startled to find, bending over to offer him a plate, a woman he recognized as the other High Priestess.
Dawn, yes, that was right.
His surprise was not reduced by her being dressed in Patricia's fashion, minus tattoos.
Dawn smiled. Your supper, my brother Ben. Thou art God.
Thou art God. Thanks.
She kissed him, got plates for herself and Jill, sat down on his right and began to eat.
Ben was sorry that she did not sit where he could see her better. She had the best attributes associated with goddesses.
No, Dawn agreed. Not yet, Jill, but waiting will fill. For example, Jill continued, I took a break to eat, but Mike hasn't eaten since the day before yesterday, and won't until he's not needed. Then he'll eat like a pig, and that will carry him as long as necessary. Besides that, Dawn and I get tired, don't we, sweet?
We surely do.
But I'm not tired, Jillian. Let me take this service and you stay with Ben. Give me that robe.
You're crazy in your little pointy head, my love. Ben, she's been on duty almost as long as Mike. We can take a long stretch, but we eat when we're hungry and sometimes we need sleep.
Speaking of robes, Dawn, this was the last in the 7th temple. I meant to tell Patty she'd better order a gross or two.
She has.
I should have known.
This one seems tight.
Jill wiggled in a fashion that disturbed Ben.
Are we putting on weight?
A little.
Good. We were too skinny.
Ben, you notice that Dawn and I have the same figure? Height, bust, waist, hips, weight, everything, not to mention coloration. We were almost alike when we met. Then with Mike's help, we matched exactly. Even our faces are more alike. But that comes from doing and thinking the same things. Stand up and let Ben look at us, dear.
Dawn put her plate aside and did so,
in a pose that reminded Ben of Jill, more than resemblance justified. Then he realized it was the pose Jill had been in when she stood revealed as Mother Eve.
Jill said with her mouth full,
See, Ben, that's me.
Dawn smiled.
A razor's edge of difference, Jillian.
Pooh.
I'm almost sorry we'll never have the same face. It's handy, Ben, for us to be alike. We must have 2 high priestesses. It's all 2 can do to keep up with Mike. And besides, she added, Dawn can buy a dress and it fits me too. Saves me the nuisance of shopping.
I wasn't sure, Ben said slowly, that you wore clothes, except these priestess things. Jill looked surprised.
How could we go out dancing in these? That's our favorite way of not getting sleep. Sit down and finish your supper. Ben has stared at us long enough. Ben, there's a man in that transition group who's a perfectly dreamy dancer, and this town is